We'll shift straight into a discussion focused on sexual assault on campus. A former Stanford University student was recently sentenced on three felony charges of sexual assault relating to an attack outside of a frat party early last year. Then-freshman Brock Turner was caught in the act by two graduate students who happened to be biking across campus as Turner thrust himself on top of an unconscious woman behind a dumpster. He ran, and the students chased him down and tackled him. Turner faced a maximum of 14 years in state prison. Prosecutors sought 6 years. He got 6 months in county jail and probation. Turner continues to deny the assault took place. The judge said he feared a longer sentence would have a severe impact on Turner, a champion swimmer with Olympic aspirations. After the sentencing, the 23-year-old victim wrote a letter to the court that has since been read millions of times online. We hear part of it now as read by reporter Jess Burns.
One day I was at work scrolling through the news on my phone and came across an article. In it, I read and learned for the first time about how I was found unconscious with my hair disheveled, long necklace wrapped around my neck, bra pulled out of my dress, dress pulled off over my shoulders and pulled up above my waist, that I was butt naked all the way down to my boots, legs spread apart, and had been penetrated by a foreign object by someone I did not recognize. This is how I learned what happened to me, sitting at my desk, reading the news at work. I learned what happened to me the same time everyone else in the world learned what happened to me. That's when the pine needles in my hair made sense. They didn't fall from a tree. He had taken off my underwear. His fingers had been inside of me. I don't even know this person. I still don't know this person. When I read about me like this, I said, "This can't be me. This can't be me." I could not digest or accept any of this information. I could not imagine my family having to read about this online. I kept reading. In the next paragraph, I read something that I will never forgive. I read that according to him, I liked it. I liked it. Again, I do not have words for these feelings.
The entire letter is over 12 pages long. In it, she goes on to address her attacker, Brock Turner, directly.
You said being drunk, I just couldn't make the best decisions, and neither could she. Alcohol is not an excuse. Is it a factor? Yes. But alcohol was not the one who stripped me, fingered me, and had my head dragged against the ground, with me almost fully naked. Having too much to drink was an amateur mistake that I admit to, but it is not criminal. Everyone in this room has had a night where they had regretted drinking too much, or know someone close to them who has had a night where they have regretted drinking too much. Regretting drinking is not the same as regretting sexual assault. We were both drunk. The difference is, I did not take off your pants and underwear, touch you inappropriately, and run away. That's the difference.
That's the statement of the victim in the Stanford sexual assault case that led to a short 6-month sentence for Brock Turner, the perpetrator. We'll discuss the case and the broader issue of campus sexual assault with a professor from Stanford and a professor from the University of Oregon when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We'll pick up the thread of a conversation we started before the break about sexual assault on college campuses. The topic was already a frequently and often angrily discussed topic, even before the recent 6-month sentence of Brock Turner for a sexual assault on the Stanford campus. Let's pick it up now, starting with the Turner case. Michelle Landis-Dauber is a law professor at Stanford and a sociologist, too. She's a member of a committee seeking to recall the judge in the Turner case. Michelle Dauber, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Fried is along with us as well. She's a psychology professor at the University of Oregon. Jennifer, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be here.
Dr. Dauber, let's start with you. You're a lawyer yourself. I mean, removing a judge is a big thing. Is this a big step for you to advocate?
No, not really, because in California, our judges are elected, not appointed, and so there is a role to play for the democratic process here. The simple fact is that had this judge made this decision 6 months ago, he wouldn't have run unopposed in his most recent election, which unfortunately was Tuesday, and he probably would have been removed at that time. So we are just calling for an election, essentially, and allowing the voters to register their feelings about this opinion.
judge's discretion is still possible in some sentences, as in this one. What's the major issue you have here?
Well, the issue we have here is that the judge really bent over backwards in order to give a sentence that is far too lenient and was indeed below the minimum sentence set forth by the California legislature for the crimes for which he was convicted. Ordinarily, assault with intent to commit rape is presumptively not eligible for probation. So he should have received at least the minimum 2-year sentence, and the average sentence for the crime he committed should have been around 4 years. So in order to give him that probation, he really had to go way out of his way, and he made some extremely questionable determinations that have been reported widely in the media.
One of the reports in the media quoted you, Dr. Dauber, as saying we need to replace him with someone who understands violence against women. I can't believe this would be the only person in a position of such authority who would need that understanding.
Agreed.
All right. So, I mean, the point is, the question relates to, is there still a large gap between what people need to understand about sexual assault in society and actually do?
Well, hopefully that'll be one of the impacts our very successful campaign to recall him and remove him from office will have. Other elected officials who have the opportunity to issue determinations like this, like other judges in the circuit court, will take a look at that recall, and they will learn more about sexual assault and violence against women.
Jennifer Fried at the University of Oregon. This is hundreds of miles away from Stanford, but there's certainly been outrage across the country to the Stanford case. Give us a sketch, if you would, about the kinds of responses and actions you've heard about at the U of O.
Well, everyone who hears about the case feels very angry, given what we know about the long-term harm that comes from sexual assault, as well as the intense injustice that we see when people are sentenced at very different ways for very different lengths of time, depending on characteristics that have to do with their level of privilege. And that injustice really makes people feel a lot of rage and distress about this case.
When you talk about the level of privilege, what are the sorts of things that confer privilege, do you think, in such cases?
Well, I mean, there's a number of demographic variables that we know are associated with sentencing injustices statistically, and certainly seem to show themselves in this case. So race, social class, and gender are big factors in this situation. So it would seem that this particular defendant was given a light sentence in part because of his privilege. And certainly there are many cases that have a very different outcome when the individuals don't have that level of privilege. I think there's that, plus the sense of outrage regarding the reality that the victim experienced. And we in my laboratory at the University of Oregon have been studying a concept we call institutional betrayal, and this case would seem to have that as well, which is when institutions that were involved in the situation. So in this situation, there'd be a university and a judicial system at a minimum. Those institutions take actions that would we now know have reasonable likelihood of causing additional harm to the victim of a sexual assault. And that, too, seems to be the case here.
Okay, I think I can understand the concept of betrayal here. It's just that, I expect something happened to me. I expect you as institutions to support me, to help me, and it didn't quite happen in this case.
That's right.
Let's talk about that concept of institutional betrayal more broadly then, in terms of sexual assault on college campuses. It's, as we talked about at the beginning, it's a topic that has been discussed loudly for years now. Enormous pressure on universities to deliver better responses to sexual assault. Are they in the perceptions of most people, Dr. Fried?
Are they doing a better job?
Yes.
I think it varies campus by campus. I certainly think we're seeing a increased level of awareness, consciousness raising is happening all over the country, and I am optimistic that that level of awareness will lead us in the right direction. I think for many campuses, we've not yet seen the sorts of changes that really will make a difference, and I'm hopeful that will come. I know of a few campuses where there really have been some positive changes, and it's very inspiring in those few cases to see how much can happen in a short amount of time. What it requires a university to do is move from institutional betrayal to institutional courage, and that requires prioritizing the safety and the civil rights of students over the reputation of the university. Interestingly, Oregon State University has recently done a number of things that have that quality, and I'm at the University of Oregon, which is about an hour away from Oregon State. Oregon State's in Corvallis, Oregon, and the president there, Ed Ray, has teamed up with a survivor of sexual assault on that very campus, and together they have made some sweeping changes and even changed laws in Oregon, but that required that president prioritize the needs of survivors over the reputation of the institution.
This is the woman who had sexual assault from the football team? Was
yes, it? Brenda yeah. Tracy, mm-hmm. a very courageous woman. I've been thinking a lot about her in the context of the case involving Stanford, another very courageous victim, and how much a difference can be made when victims do find a way to speak out in such a public way.
Jennifer Fried is a psychology professor at the University of Oregon. Michelle Landis-Dauber, law professor and sociologist at Stanford University. Dr. Dauber, you worked with Stanford, many other schools, apparently, to revise sex assault policies. I mean, how different are they now from what they were a few years ago?
Well, I would say some of these policies are improving, definitely over what they were, say, 10 years ago. And that, you know, that's mostly because the federal government has made it clear that schools have to protect, at least at some minimal level, the rights of people, students, to be free from sexual assault and sexual harassment. But I do want to emphasize something that Professor Fried was saying in this vein, which is that, you know, her research on institutional betrayal is extremely important, and with the young people that I have assisted navigate Stanford's, you know, quite burdensome process and get bad outcomes, you know, they will tell you that they feel that the way they were treated by the university was worse than the sexual attack. And I'm sure, you know, that indicates the level of harm that it causes when institutions that people look to for protection and trust, like the court system and like Stanford, magnify their pain by hurting them. And I can tell you that I witnessed the institutional betrayal of this young victim because I was with her in court at the sentencing, and you could see the trauma that this judge's ruling was imposing on her and on her family and on her sister and on the witnesses in the case. I was with a group of her friends from high school and college, and the parents of those friends, and everyone in the room was crying, and it was horrible. It was just horrible.
Why would a university like Stanford, or any for that matter, still have what you describe as a burdensome process? I mean, examples are out there of moving what began as the Children's Advocacy Center concept, where you get interviewed in a soft situation. You're not in the police station with the hot fluorescent lights and all that stuff around you. And yet it seems like that has not translated to campuses responding in that way to a lot of sexual assaults.
I mean, the reasons that universities sometimes, you know, mishandle these processes are, many. One that has been the focus of attention is, of course, the desire to protect the brand of the institution, or to protect the institution, or to protect the people who work within the institution who may have screwed something up at some point in the case, sort of in prioritizing that more than the safety of the victim. I also think that there is a problem with the lack of transparency and secrecy that really feeds into the, you know, sort of multiple level institutional failures in these cases, which is that the you know, a lot of these decisions are made by a small group of university administrators who suffer, I would say, from groupthink to some extent, and they do things without transparency, and they sort of, you know, it's like maybe the provost and the president and the university council and some dean, and, you know, they're all agreeing with each other. You know, they're all in a room alone saying, yeah, yeah, we don't need to apologize to that girl who was, you know, sexually assaulted in the dirt next to a dumpster on our property at a fraternity house that is a sanctioned organization and had a university-sponsored party. Why would we apologize to her for that? And why would we pay for her therapy? And they're all in agreement. And then when their, you know, decision that makes no sense except to them in their closed room leaks out into the outside world, the world delivers to them the message, as is happening right now, that it does not agree. And they're quite stunned by that, and they become quite defensive of the university and of each other and of themselves and of their decision-making. And, you know, I think that is really sort of the core problem, is the lack of transparency and the kind of multiple level institutional failures.
Dr. Fried, as we broaden out into society at large, not just within college campuses, is there still a level of excuse making for youth, for lousy decision making, for being drunk, that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, we see it in this case and in many other cases where various basically tactics of denial are raised. These include excuses. It includes blaming the victim, and actually often reversing, in some sense, the role of victim and perpetrator. So it's quite common in sexual assault situations to see the victim be described essentially as a perpetrator, to dare to make such an accusation against the actual perpetrator, who then becomes the victim of a quote, false accusation.
Yeah, the old "I can't believe you're doing this to me" thing, which leads to Brock Turner's father in the case speaking of his son's life being messed up. I mean, it drew gasps when he said it, and probably everybody's heard it since that time. But this is not an uncommon thing, I'm thinking, Dr. Dauber.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that he had a poor word choice. I think he called it an unfortunate choice of words in his, which, you know, true, in his public statement. You know, it has caught on, and it did upset people, and I am the one that tweeted it and stuff. But I think that you know, there are many other things in his statement that are equally offensive. For example, the fact that he mentioned, you know, as evidence of how upset his son was or how destroyed his life was, that he, you know, was no longer eating his favorite snacks. He didn't like pretzels anymore, and he wouldn't grill a ribeye. And, you know, and he was sort of creating a moral equivalence between, you know, that sort of thing and being sexually assaulted. And I think that that's in many ways, you know, more offensive and also more indicative of the minimization of the survivor's trauma and of his son's actions, and just sort of a generalized, you know, very, you know, sort of steeped in rape culture kind of, you know, idea.
I don't know if either of you had a chance to look at a Washington Post article out this week that had the whole list of sexual assault incidence rates on college campuses all over the country. Brown University came out looking pretty bad. University of Connecticut came out looking pretty bad. Reed College in the Portland area had a very high rate, but the administration said that's good because it means that people are reporting sexual assault. Is this an unusual response, Jennifer Fried?
Yes, and I think Reed has actually been one of the places where we've seen some more progressive actions. And I totally agree that it would be a terrible mistake to assume that these reports reflect the actual numbers. They absolutely don't. Let me give you an example, because I've done quite a bit of research on my own campus. We're much bigger than Reed, but we have about 20,000 undergraduates, and we've now done two campus surveys. And I'm going to give you conservative estimates here. Approximately 20% of our undergraduate students get exposed to rape or attempted rape. I'm not counting in that other forms of sexual assault, like touching and so on. Just rape and attempted rape, that's 20% over their time. This means that per year, about 1,000 new cases. And we know that right now that most people don't report, but some number, in fact, do report, and it's about 10%, so about 100 are going to be reporting. And we do not begin to see that number in the official statistics right now. So we've got breakdowns occurring all along. We've got breakdowns occurring in people's willingness to report, and that's very much related to institutional betrayal because they're not going to be willing to report unless they really can trust that reporting won't make their life worse. And then there's breakdowns in what happens to that information once it gets to the system. While I think it's exceedingly important that we respect survivors' autonomy, and if they want to have a private discussion, we let them have a private discussion. But often when people report, they want that information to go forward, and it's extremely important when they want it to go forward, it doesn't get buried somewhere in the system. I think Reed has taken a step to address all these problems, and they've got a long way to go, but, you know, I've been in contact with some of the administrators there. They reached out to me. I think they sincerely, at least some of them, are really trying to do something. So I was a little upset by the Washington Post article because while it did acknowledge this viewpoint, it still made it seem like the universities who are reporting higher numbers were worse places when I would say probably they're taking steps to address this.
All right. Well, a lot of steps being taken in a lot of places and a lot of ground left to cover. I want to thank you both for joining us today. Jennifer Fried is a psychology professor at the University of Oregon. Michelle Landis-Dauber, law professor at Stanford and a sociologist, too. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.